I must admit, this is a very exciting moment for me. My mother is in the audience. As many of you know, my father graduated from here, so I'm really happy. My first question is, so you're a native of Brooklyn. You attended Cornell as an undergraduate in Harvard and Columbia law schools. I'm curious about your path to law school in particular, how you decided you were interested in a career in the law.
I decided to become a lawyer thanks to a great teacher I had at Cornell, Robert E. Cushman, professor of government. I attended Cornell from 1950 to 1954. It was not a good time for our nation. It was the heyday of Senator Joe McCarthy, who saw a communist in every corner. People were being hauled before the House Un-American Activities Committee and the counterpart Senate Committee. They were quizzed about some organization they had belonged to in the height of the Depression when they were students. Professor Cushman impressed on me that our nation was straying from its deepest values. That is, we all have the right to think, speak, and write as we believe, and not as a big brother government tells us is the right way to think, speak, and write. So I had the idea that being a lawyer was a pretty nifty thing to do. You could earn a living, I thought, and at the same time, do something to help make your society a little better. So that's when I decided to go to law school. I also had the good fortune of having a best friend and husband for 56 years who was a year ahead of me at Cornell, and we decided that whatever we would do together. Medical school was ruled out because chemistry had labs in the afternoon, and that interfered with my husband's golf practice. So then it was the possibility of business school. For some reason, Marty wanted to go to Harvard. The Harvard Business School did not admit women in the 50s, not until the mid-60s. So there was law school. And it turned out to be a very good choice for both of us.
I think that's true for all of us. Western and Central New York were the home of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and other inspiring women in the suffragist movement. You have inspired so many people as an advocate for women's rights. Nationwide, we are about to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, providing men and women with equal voting rights. Is there a woman who has inspired you to action and who otherwise influential as you progress through your career?
In my growing up years, I can't say that I had a role model of women in the law because women were barely there. But I did have two inspirers. One was real and the other fictional. The real model was Amelia Earhart,
yes,
who was doing something that women just didn't do in her day. And the fictional character was Nancy Drew, who was a doer, an actor, and she led her boyfriend to be her partner in solving crimes. But as I grew up and became a lawyer, there were some very brave women that whose life encouraged me. And one is a woman named Belva Lockwood, who in the year 1876 applied to be admitted to the bar of the U.S. Supreme Court. Her application was turned down 6-3 for one reason. She was a woman. But Belva Lockwood was not the type to go off in a corner and cry about her sad fate. Instead, she lobbied the Congress relentlessly for 3 years, and in the year 1879, Congress passed a law that said women who possess the necessary qualifications must be admitted to the Supreme Court bar. It's my favorite example of how sometimes the legislature is more in tune with changing times than the court. In any case, Belva Lockwood wasn't satisfied with becoming a member of the bar. She did argue a case her very first year as a member. She was well into her 70s when she argued her last case. It was on behalf of the Cherokee Indians who had been dispossessed from their ancestral land in Georgia and marched in the Trail of Tears to Oklahoma. Belva Lockwood ran for president twice, in the year 1884 and 1888, in something she called the Equal Rights Party. People were astonished. They said, how can you run for office? You can't even vote. And she said, and she took out her pocket constitution and said, there's nothing in here that says I can't be president. So she was one really inspirational character. Another is when I was appointed to the D.C. Circuit in 1980, the first woman ever appointed to a federal district court judgeship, Bernita Sheldon Matthews, was still alive. She was well into her 90s. She was losing her eyesight and her hearing was not very good, but her brain power was undiminished. I met with her from time to time, and she told me wonderful stories about the not so good old days when she was counsel to the National Women's Party. That was the group that split off from the main branch of the suffrage movement, the group that said, we're not satisfied with the vote. We want equality in all dimensions of life. And so the National Women's Party introduced the Equal Rights Amendment in 1923 and every year thereafter. The National Women's Party had its headquarters on the site where the Supreme Court now stands. Bernita Shelton Matthews was a specialist in eminent domain. And when the government condemned the land to build the Supreme Court, she said, this is a very valuable property and we should get a substantial award. The government argued it was just a ramshackle old building, not worth very much. Bernita Shelton Matthews called as a witness a member of the older inhabitants of D.C., who said he recalled that the building had been used as a jail for notorious Confederate spies. The government would have none of that. So then she introduced a photograph of a notorious Confederate spy who happened to be a woman inside that building. At that point, the government's case collapsed and Bernita Shelton Matthews got for her client, the National Women's Party, the largest condemnation award that up to then had ever been paid by the U.S. government. She was going to law school at night while working during the day, and she was taking part in the protests in front of the White House. So she would go there and hold up her sign, Votes for Women. She said she would never allow the police to elicit a response from her. She didn't speak a word because she didn't want to risk her membership becoming a member of the bar by having any kind of arrest record. She was a woman from Mississippi with a soft southern drawl, but she was a woman of steel. When she was on the district court, U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia, she engaged only women as her law clerks. And when she was asked why, she said, because my colleagues don't engage any women. And she maintained that she always had the best law clerks in the building.
Well, your groundbreaking career has included serving as co-founder of the ACLU's Women's Rights Project, as an attorney for the ACLU, and as an academic and scholar who published extensively on sex discrimination. Where did your passion for social justice come by?
I spoke earlier about Professor Cushman at Cornell. And the notion that lawyers could make a difference. Lawyers appearing with their clients before the investigating committees and reminding our Congress that we have a First Amendment that guarantees freedom of expression. We have a Fifth Amendment that protects us against self-incrimination. And then from experiencing odious discrimination, I grew up, I was in grade school during World War II. We were fighting a war against racism. And yet, there was an irony because our own troops, almost to the end of the war, were rigidly separated by race. I think the Holocaust was an important step in bringing about the end of apartheid in America. I think when Brown v. Board finally came before the Supreme Court, the government filed a brief urging that we are embarrassed by the Soviet Union calling us racist. Please, Supreme Court, end enforced separation of the races in schools. And then, as I said just a few minutes before, at the end of the 60s, when it became possible to achieve what women had sought from Abigail Adams on, when society was ready to listen, when courts were ready to listen, what an exhilarating time that was for me. We had a list of all the provisions of the U.S. Code that differentiated on the basis of gender. And those were our targets. Inside of a decade, almost all of those differentials had gone. So, in a sense, we had an easy target. There was nothing subtle about it. It was, women are this way and men are that way, and never the twain shall meet. Women took care of the home and children, men earned the bread for the family. So being part of that effort, as I said before, was thinking about the women in the prior generation who had said the same things we were saying. One woman, I hope people in this audience will recognize her name, because she was a real pathbreaker. Her name was Pauline Murray. She was on the ACLU board, and we overlapped on the board. She had gone to Howard Law School in the 1940s. Mm-hmm. She organized the students at Howard to sit in at the local lunch places because they refused to serve African Americans. This is in the 40s, long before the sit-ins of the 60s. She had gone to Hunter College in New York, and she was taking a white friend of hers back to North Carolina to visit her family. They cross the Mason-Dixon line, and she is told to go to the back of the bus. She refuses, she's arrested. Again, this is in the 1940s, long before Rosa Parks. She is finally getting the recognition that she deserves. There are two very good biographies of her. There's a residence at Yale. She had her Doctor of Laws degree from Yale that has been named after her. The name of a slave owner was removed, and Pauline's name was substituted. So she was one of the people instrumental in persuading that the ACLU, that gender equality should be on every human rights agenda.
It's impressive. So you've taken us from the suffrage movement to Seneca Falls to civil rights, and I'm going to ask you now about the case that Chancellor Johnson mentioned. You've become renowned for arguing against limitations on the basis of sex, and in 1996, in U.S. Versus Virginia decision involving the Virginia Military Institute's admissions policy excluding women, you wrote that full citizenship for women requires equal opportunity to aspire, achieve, participate in, and contribute to society. Looking ahead and through the lens of law, what do you mean by that, and what else needs to be done in this regard?
First, as a preface, may I say why I stopped using sex and started using gender. It was a secretary I had at Columbia Law School who said, I'm typing these briefs and these speeches for you, and the word sex juts out all over. She said, don't you know that the audience you are addressing, their first association of the word sex is not what you want them to be thinking about. So she suggested, use a grammatical term, use gender. It will ward off distracting associations. So now, the question you asked?
It is distracting, yes. On the Virginia Military Institute
So, was something revealing about the title of that case. It was the United States against Virginia. Mm-hmm. It was the U.S. government telling the state of Virginia, you cannot have an educational opportunity and make it available to one sex and not the other. There was a predecessor to the Virginia Military Institute case. And it was a decision that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote her very first year on the court. So in 1982, the case was Hogan against Mississippi University for Women. Hogan was a man who wanted to get a nursing degree. And the best nursing school in his vicinity was the Mississippi University for Women. He was turned down because of his gender. Justice O'Connor wrote a decision holding that the state, that in that case Mississippi, could not deny any person the opportunity for an education solely on the basis of gender. That was the principal precedent for the Virginia Military Institute case. And when the case was before the court, some people said to me, well, who would want to go to VMI with its rat line and its very harsh, Spartan quarters? What woman would want to go to such a school? And I said, well, I wouldn't want to go there. But I don't think you would either. But there are women who want that opportunity, are fully qualified to survive the rat line and any other obstacles. One of the brightest days I had was 21 years after the VMI decision. I was invited to VMI, and the commander was exuberant about the women cadets. These were women who wanted to be engineered, one wanted to be an atomic scientist. It was a true success story. Well, one of the reasons why it was such a success is that VMI was able to upgrade its applicant pool very substantially. The beginning was rocky. VMI's attitude was, we make no concessions for the women. When the men come in, they get their heads shaved, the women too. After a couple of years, they realized that wasn't necessary. But the women are leaders of their class. A couple of years later, I visited West Point. The women were elated because they had just dropped the combat exclusion for women. Again, women who were fully prepared for that kind of education and wanted to be, to climb to the top of the tree. Mm-hmm. So VMI, as it turned out, ended up with only one dissent, and that was my dear friend Justice Scalia. He wrote a rather strident dissent, but as an illustration of our friendship, he came to my chambers one day and he threw down a sheaf of paper and he said, this is the penultimate draft of my VMI dissent. I'm not yet ready to circulate to the court, but I want to give you as much time as I can to answer it. So I was about to go off to the Second Circuit Judicial Conference in Lake George. I opened the dissent on the plane, and it absolutely ruined my weekend. But I was certainly glad to have the extra days. His prophecy that the decision would mark the end of VMI turned out to be altogether wrong. Mm.
I think we're going to have to dig deeper with Justice Scalia. Your friendship with him is the stuff of legend. Can you also tell us some other memorable arguments and how do you manage to move beyond them?
Well, one of them was certainly Bush v. Gore.
Small.
When I disagreed strongly with the equal protection rationale that he signed on to and thought it was uncharacteristic of him. The Bush v. Gore was an endurance contest because the court granted review on Saturday, briefs filed Sunday, oral argument Monday, decisions out on Tuesday. I was still in chambers. It was 9 o'clock at night. The telephone rings, and it's Justice Scalia asking, "What am I doing still at the court?" He said, "Go home and take a hot bath." We had certain interests in common. One, we both cared a lot about families. We would celebrate New Year's Eve together with whatever children wanted to come along. And we shared a passion for opera. Justice Scalia, by the way, was the only one of my colleagues who could carry a tune. So he had thought for years that Italian opera was what he loved, not German opera. So I said, let's go to the Metz production of Valkyrie and see what you think. Now, it was somewhat of a risk on my part because Valkyrie runs maybe 5 hours. But he was entranced because there's some very beautiful music in that opera.
It is beautiful. I have a question for you as a writer. You have been in the public eye for much of your career, and many authors have written about you. What have they gotten right, and what have they gotten wrong?
Well, there are now more books than I can count. But the full story will be told by my official biographers, Wendy Williams and Mary Hartnett. And they've been working on this for, at least 15 years. Some of the two in particular that I enjoy, is one is the children's book, I Dissent. Children love it because it tells them it's okay to say no. And it starts out when I'm in first grade, I'm left-handed. The teacher is encouraging me to use my right hand. I try for one test, and I get back a D, and I said, never again. I will write with my left hand.
I'm going to follow up with you about children. Your image has appeared on T-shirts, on comic books, coloring books, and tattoos. Children dress up as you for History Day at school. What do you attribute your popularity to among young people?
To a second-year student at NYU Law School. When the Supreme Court decided the Shelby County case that declared unconstitutional the key provision of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, she was angry. And then she thought to herself, anger is not a useful emotion. It will get me nowhere. I should do something positive. So she took the announcement of my dissent that I read from the bench, and she created a Tumblr
Tumblr.
Yes, and that's how it all began. She called it The Notorious RBG. After The Notorious B.I.G.
Yes.
Which she said was altogether fitting and proper because, after all, we had one important thing in common. We were both born and bred in Brooklyn, New York.
Oh!
And then from that beginning, it just took took off into outer space.
Well, the home crowd is definitely in love with that story. So I think it's also well-deserved. Sadly, we only have time for one last question before we have to end our discussion today. So this is a useful one. We have many law students in the audience, and some of them, I think, aspire to also be judges. So I was hoping if you could ask, what is one characteristic you believe all successful judges share, and what type of, why is that characteristic important?
I'd say two. One is patience, and the other is a willingness to listen and to learn. My recently deceased colleague, Justice John Paul Stevens, was a very good listener. Mm-hmm. And he spoke about how much he learned on the bench by listening to the advocates, by listening to his colleagues in conference. Compassion is another quality. Law doesn't exist somewhere in the sky. It exists to govern society. Law exists to serve that society. So an appreciation of what law is all about, to help keep society operating peacefully. I think it's important to realize that law is not some kind of abstract exercise. It affects real people, and judges should be cognizant of how the law affects the people that law is meant to serve.
Very well said. Justice Ginsburg, it has been an honor and a privilege.